Sorry, not the usual disclaimer today.
Yeah, we're ready to go.
You're going.
All right.
Sorry about that.
Hey, we had radio silence.
My headphones didn't have any sound.
Yeah, I didn't get my usual cue.
Terribly sorry.
So the
music played and all that good stuff.
We the people radio online. Yeah, here we go.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ryan.
Hi, my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape will get you pretty much anything you need when it comes to John Deere products. Full parts and service. They do it all. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard up in the city of Shasta Lake, right in between the Pine Grove and Oasis exits, just two doors down from Phil's Propeller. But go up and see them and get your John Deere needs or even any other brand. I think they work on pretty much any brand of tractor you've got. They'll take care of you. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There.
So
what do we got going today, Aaron?
Okay. Well, Bill, actually what we have going is we have some really nice people who sponsor the show besides Pape Machinery.
Yes.
Not that we do not love them. Mike, can you say that? That's like 17 negatives in a row. Anyway, we love the Pape Machinery, folks. But thank you so much to all the individuals who fire off sponsorship to the show. So this week's acknowledgement goes to Ellen. Thanks, Ellen, for sponsoring We the People so we can bring you fun information. And, you know, for people who potentially haven't been really following or don't follow every week, I really, really would encourage you to go back to August 6th, 2023, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children with our guest Paul Skinner. He is going to come on and speak with us about specifically on the topic of exploitation of children and then on missing children. So we're going to do two different shows. He is working on finding children at the moment, said he was going to be busy on cases for a few weeks, but he's going to come back on and talk to us some more about that. So for those of you that have keyed into Sound of Freedom and are wondering if anybody's doing anything about any of this, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children does an excellent job. They partner with all of our law enforcement agencies around the country, full of really interesting professionals who do all sorts of different things and lend a hand free of charge to our law enforcement folks in the things that they need.
And we got some good feedback on that show, too. A lot of people listened to it and liked it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there are things that you don't see that much, but it's funny. It's kind of like, I think, if you buy a red car, all of a sudden you notice how many red cars there are. We were watching a show the other night. It was about some person that was missing, and they kept flashing up the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children logo.
Yeah.
And I guess I've seen it before, but didn't really know what it was. So, anyway, I hope you will take a listen to that. So, today is August 20th, and we are speaking with Nathan Deshmaker, minerals, coal, and energy. But his article is All Roads Lead to Rome. And I thought, that's a fun title. So we've posted that for you, so you can go and actually read his article. He and his family raise registered feeder calves in central Montana. He's a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures, land and natural resource policy making, local government regulations, and program management. And he doesn't work for the government, P.S. Nathan is also an accomplished musician and a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. That's probably why he's so smart, you know? It's the classics, right? The stuff that comes out now, not so great. He has worked with local governments to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations facing increased pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the U.S. And tell you what, anybody who deals with agriculture or folks who are in agriculture knows that the pressure is unbelievable right now.
Oh, they're grabbing land like crazy.
I'm just not sure where people think they're going to get their food.
Yeah.
That is the overwhelming question. So, Nathan, do you know where we're going to get our food? Is that what we're you're going to answer that burning question for us today?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that we can maybe touch on that a little bit. That's a pretty good question on where food will come from when you know, I think we have case examples historically. You can see communists. The state or government has never been successful farmers.
No.
Communist systems show that pretty clearly. So we need to protect and preserve liberty of the individual and private property and access and utilization of resources for the betterment of mankind and particularly our nation of people who are covenanted together on those principles of liberty. So that's what I've been talking about more is, you know, not just the issues of where our food's going to be coming from, but how did we as a people get so removed from the foundational principles that our founders so adamantly relied on?
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned in your article was any place the government has basically restricted the use of private property and people's rights, those societies have inherently failed. And I think
it makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
Who cares for the land the best? The people who own it or the people who just sit around in an office and talk about it all day? You know, I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. Who takes care of your house better? You know, you or the city that you live in that makes all the rules that you have to follow? It's always the people. They always do a much better job.
Yeah, I would agree. It's fundamental. And I was having a discussion with somebody here the other day on the fundamental need for active citizen involvement in government in our country. The problem is government in our country has become so bureaucratic that the process is so convoluted with, as you were just saying, I'll use what I call swivel chair experts. that's where the rulemaking is coming from, is those realms. And so that's maybe one of the things we can touch on is the stuff that's been on my desk is in relationship to Montana, but also has impacts across the West. Two things. One is our coal is under attack in some significant ways. And then the other side of that is we can hear maybe is there's a lot of things moving to push for renewable development. And now there's currently regulatory rewrites of right-of-way rules for access to our public lands. And for energy development to take place on public lands, there's right-of-way fees and acreage fees. You know, you don't just go and file for a lease to develop oil and gas or a wind farm. There's fees that are involved with those things. So what's happening right now, BLM is rewriting the regulations to reduce the acreage fees and the capacity fees for wind and solar, while at the same time they're bringing forward regulations to increase those costs for the oil and gas sector. So those are some pretty big issues of picking winners and losers in the energy environment and the access of lands for generating electricity. And we know that wind and solar is really not super effective. It's not putting out the capacity of energy that it's that the nameplates, when they put in a wind farm, it's supposed to reach a certain amount of gigawatt electricity and power generation. And from data out of the European Union, they're only reaching like combined average of like 18% of the capacity rate for what they've put in for generation.
That's what they've sold is these great outputs, but in actuality, it's 18%.
Well, that was out of a study in the European Union from 2011 to 2021 of laying out the actual percentage that they reached of what their the nameplate capacity was. That study also did a cost-benefit comparison of how much overspend there is compared to if they just were using conventional energy sources like natural gas. And the overspend in the long term was like $1.8 trillion, and then the capital overspend over gas firing systems was over $600 billion. So it's massively subsidized. It's not, you know, and one of the questions I asked in a recent paper somewhere I put out there was, so the Nature Conservancy and Princeton and, you know, the Cloud 10 organization or whatever it's called, they all put out a white paper saying that we need as much lands as Wyoming and Colorado combined for wind and solar development to reach 2050 net zero objectives. But so here's a question. Are they basing that on the nameplate capacity of wind and solar, which they're only reaching like 20% of that nameplate capacity? And if that's the case, that just shows we're going to need a heck of a lot more land than Wyoming and Colorado for wind and solar development to meet those generation targets. Right. And so it's just appalling they're even pushing in that direction based on those realities.
Well, yeah. And then you have, what do you do with all the blades from the wind things? They've got to bury those because there's nowhere to put them and no way to recycle them. And all the things that go into it for what we get out of it. I don't remember if I said anything about it last week, but I was looking at vehicles, and there was one of these, you know, hybrid deals, which would not be my deal. But it is a plugging in hybrid. And so I don't know. I just got randomly curious. I wonder how much you get on the plugging in part, you know. So I started reading down into the details. Yeah, you can leave your car plugged in like a toaster in your garage all night, and you can get 25 miles out of that before you switch to gas.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? And it was, you know, so much more expensive than the regular version of the vehicle. And I thought, that's just a feel-good thing.
Yeah, how's that ever going to pencil out? I mean, you spend all that extra on a hybrid.
25
then,
miles?
Yeah. Take forever to pay for it. So on the flip side of subsidizing all this wind and solar and you know, trying to grab all this land to implement it, they're on the other side, they're cutting back on coal, hydro, you know, all these,
taking out the dams.
Yeah, taking out dams, and these are all systems that are much cheaper to produce energy and much more efficient and much more dependable, but they're going to try to do away with all that. I just don't see how that's
how that's ever going to happen by 2050. Space, right? Like, there's a huge use of, you know, like what you're seeing in Montana. They want to use our open space for that. Is that kind of where they're headed with this?
Well, I think there's, you know, Montana, they're pushing the wind and solar development across multiple states, in particular the West. So when it comes to the public lands, federal lands out there, they're rewriting things and reducing. So the problem they're facing is private investment, private enterprise aren't, even with the subsidies in some cases, making capital investments for wind and solar development on public lands. One of the justifications BLM claims for promulgating this rule to reduce the acreage rates and the fee rates is to incentivize more private capital investment. So that tells me that Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior, rightfully so, are anticipating significant wind and solar development shortfalls in capital investment. So instead of them stepping back and being like, okay, the private market and enterprise aren't investing fast enough, maybe there's not returns here that justify the investment. And that's the problem with this rule and these other rules they're promulgating with all this. where's the cost-benefit impacts analysis in relationship to the impacts both on the environment? One, they're going to need massive amount of lands for the transition. And two, for the socioeconomic impacts by, because like you said, they're also trying to shut down access and leasability of our coal estate in Montana and other places across the West, oil and gas development. So where's that cost-benefit analysis? And then the answer is there really hasn't been one officially through the federal departments that are implementing these executive actions. And I say executive because most of these goals and objectives, the net zero 2050, 30 by 30 objectives, transitioning the grid to carbon neutral sources by 2035, none of that's been delegated to executive departments via congressional law. So it's all executive orders that set those targets and objectives. But what's happening, the way those, most people know those things are out there, but we have bureaucracy, federal departments and agencies that are implementing that through rulemaking. And here's one example of where they're doing that is lessening the fee rates to give an unfair advantage to wind and solar development. And like I said, at the same time, they're increasing the like-kind fee rates for oil and gas. So it's
so they're
not allowing the market to work.
Right, right, right. And another way of picking the winners and the losers. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's pick up on that thread that we should play a couple songs about fools because it just seemed like a good theme. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Change, change, change.
Hi, this is James Brown, soul brother number one, always fighting. Now I'm fighting for your life. I'm fighting for your life because if you use drugs, you better leave it alone. Drugs are contagious. They're killers. Every drug is a killer. Stay away from drugs. Drugs will take your life away. And if you want to live, stay away from drugs because they are super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad. Super bad.
The human race was dying out. No one left to scream and shout. People walking on the moon. Smog will get you pretty soon. Everyone was hanging out, hanging up and hanging down, hanging in and holding fast. Hope our little world will last.
Yes, hope our little world will last. So, Go back, Nathan, to the picking of the winners and losers using basically using regulatory authority and fee structure.
Yeah, so what I'll do actually, I'm going to actually touch on what you mentioned earlier about the reclamation of these things when they go out, and then we can shift over to
okay,
the economic
yeah.
side a little bit. I just wanted to
you
touch
drive
on
the bus.
That, though,
I'm sorry. I'll get back in the back. I don't drive the bus. What was I doing? I lost my mind.
No,
I grabbed for the wheel
you're good.
And I was wrong.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to capture this because otherwise we'll move forward and I'll forget to bring it up. So
okay.
I just wanted to bring it forward anyways. So you mentioned wind, the solar or the windmills, you know, what do they do with them? They just pile them in a dump somewhere or whatever. So the justification from Department of Interior or BLM on the oil and gas leasing rule, which is increasing costs, They state the onshore program, and that is for oil and gas leasing and development, historically has failed to provide the federal government with a fair return, exposed the federal government to significant reclamation-related liabilities, lacked adequate cost recovery mechanisms, and encouraged speculative leasing and wasteful development practices. So that's what they state on the Federal Register regarding oil and gas. But every single criteria they list of their of the concerns with oil and gas, not bringing in a return on the investment, having significant reclamation-related liabilities, and no recovery mechanisms, and a speculative leasing and wasteful development practices, every single one of those criteria, if you take that and apply it to wind and solar development, it is significantly multiplied, because oil and gas, for instance, provides about a thousand times as much gigawatt generation per unit of land as wind and solar. So, and that's something that's called power density, which is an actual equation of how much energy generation you get per unit of land. So they're concerned about oil and gas not having reclamation related liability or having those issues, like I said, are amplified significantly on the wind and solar, because they're going to be taking up a whole bunch more land when they expire. Think about the costs. I mean, we're pumping trillions of dollars into this through the Inflation Reduction Act and other Build Back Better Act and all this subsidies spending. But there's no provisions in that spending of accounting for the downstream costs of having to dismantle those 20, 25, 30 years. Or if you're a solar farm that got hailed out a year from now, to reclaim those things in an economically, you know, beneficial manner. And so those are the types of things. They're really not, it's not only picking winners and losers in the fee rates and in the economic aspect, but on the impacts analysis side of it as well. They're blaming oil and gas for a criteria set of impacts that are significantly amplified under wind and solar development scenarios, but they're not even looking at that in their wind and solar rules.
Yeah, it's kind of a one-sided analysis at that point. They recognize one, but they don't want to bring up the other.
Let's not bring up the unpleasantness, right? That makes it also creates just a lot of fighting. You know, you just have a lot of argument with all this stuff, and so people point to the way that the government chooses these, thinking that means that's the best choice. I mean, that's the default position is, well, it must be good if that's what they're using, which is obviously not accurate.
Exactly. And, you know, back to markets and private investment, our constitutional republic and the system of government our founders established was very much in the context of understanding, as I mentioned earlier, private property. But that also, it, by extension, acknowledges private property in the means of production. And even federal statutes to this day, the Mineral Leasing Act, the Minerals and Mining Policy Act, Federal Land Policy Management Act, many statutes in place in relationship to our mineral estate and those important industries prioritizes the facilitation of private industry or private enterprise investment and development of those resources. So our laws, like the minerals laws, for instance, directs government to facilitate an environment that allows private investment in those industries. And that doesn't mean subsidizing them, but giving access and investment access for capital investment in those industries to the private individual and private enterprise. So those things, not only are they embedded constitutionally in our republic, but it's really in a lot of our laws. And what we have now is that, as we all know, a way out of control administration that thinks even though we have a couple hundred years of failed experiments of central economic planning, that now they think they can do it in a way that actually benefits the people and the individual person. And that's the test they now have. And I think I would submit they're already failing that test because we have increased costs, we have inflation, some big issues on that front.
Oh yeah, just when you look at the mandates, then we mandate everything. So it isn't even like we're going to find out if it's a good idea. We're going to first make rules about it, force everyone to do it, and then in the meantime, there are some real world consequences. You have some auto manufacturers that are taking huge hits because they've been incentivized to make all these electric vehicles, but they're not selling necessarily as many as they need to sell because people have figured out. I realize most of them go more than 25 miles on a charge, but you know, when they figure out that's what happens, and you have to pay for the electricity. It doesn't just come out of the air.
Well, aside from the fact that, you know, fuel prices have gone through the roof as far as gasoline and diesel, people are struggling to afford that, and some reason they think the flip side's going to be, let's go out and buy an electric vehicle for $60,000. They can't afford the gas. How are they going to afford a $60,000 EV? I mean, that just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. Not only if they can afford it, but even if they could afford it, of whether or not that's their preferred purchase.
Yeah, right.
That's the other side of this is, and I'm glad you bring up the car deal, because that's another good example of forcing manufacturing development that's not driven by free markets and the consent of the demand of the consumer.
Right. And now the consumers are...
That's not good.
No, and consumers are weighing in. I read an article last week. I'd like to tell you where I read it. I'll search for it. I'm posting one. Peter Huntsman wrote a great article about climate change and kind of the way he looks at that from a business standpoint. He had some really, really solid points in that article. And but I had read a thing from a guy who lived in Canada, bought an electric truck, and took his family. They were going to go to Chicago or something. And it was like stopping, charging. Oh, wait. Stopping. Got to stop again. Got to charge. Oh, wait. The charging station's broken. Uh-oh. We could only go another, I don't know. He was down to the wire. Went to the next charging station. That was broken. And he's like, he was into this truck deep. I forget what he said. Like 70,000, 80,000 bucks. It was a lot of money. He's like, now I'm stuck with this truck. And I can't even go on a trip with my family because you can't get there from here.
Well, there was an article just a couple days ago about a Ford executive that took a cross-country trip in their new Ford EV just to kind of test it out. And
maybe that's the same one.
That could be.
Did he get hung up all the time?
Well, yeah. His words were the trip was somewhat challenging because of the lack of charging stations, the lack of being able to travel more than just a few hundred miles before you had to have a charge, and then the wait times because they didn't have quick chargers. They had to use regular chargers. It took hours to run a charge, and as a result, they're teaming up with Tesla now to develop quick chargers for their vehicles because they don't have the technology to really make those trucks feasible and marketable. People are looking at it and going, gosh, I don't want to have those problems. I travel and, you know, I don't want to have to, you know, drive a couple hundred miles and then have to sit and wait for 45 minutes to 2-3 hours to charge. So there's some real problems with that technology, and I think the manufacturers are now starting to recognize that. And I'm not sure where do they go from here.
Those are good points. Then there's some car companies, I believe Toyota was one of them, that never did really jump down, that rightfully anticipated, you might get a lot of money up front to push this investment, but now the ones who took that quote-unquote free money, and now you have cars sitting on the lot and this and that. And back to the articles you guys are mentioning, you know, I don't, the people behind the electric car movement are really, it's more about, they don't want commuting and significant travel and the freedom or to relocate. And I think that's logically the reason they're pushing the EVs is because even with a significant investment of infrastructure, if we had no alternative than electric vehicles and no more gas vehicles, which were a long ways out from that, honestly, it could never be done in a way that maintains the market order and the traveling context that we have the capacity to today. Not just traveling, but extraction of raw resources, including the agricultural industry, because I'm not out here in an EV tractor driving around plowing the ground. Not going to happen.
Well,
so electric vehicles are like a glorified bicycle, pretty much.
Yeah, and if you live in a rural area like you, you're not in this big city where you're only driving a few miles every day. You have to drive long distances, and if you were to go to a completely electric vehicle society, you're cutting out huge swaths of the population for their ability to move around. I just don't see where that's going to fly.
Well, that article from Peter Huntsman, I just posted it. So if people would like to read it, that's on the page for today.
Well, one of the points he makes in that article that I thought was very telling was, you know, they talk about the carbon output of the United States and how many metric tons it is. Well, he was saying that back in the 1970s when they measured carbon output in industry, it's pretty much the same as it is today, which is fine, but the actual production of products has gone up 10 times what it was in the 70s with the same amount of carbon output. And nobody talks about that. All they talk about is we have to reduce it. But we have made major strides in creating technologies that produce a lot more for a lot less.
Agreed. And, you know, it's back to that power density. And I read the other day in a piece that actually come from the other camp that's pushing for all this, but acknowledge the fact, and this is a pretty profound thing to think about. 50 gallons of oil, 50-gallon drum of oil, in energy equivalence is around 4.5 years of a single person's labor. No horses, no anything, just you. You know, I hauled 12 bales of, 1,300-pound bales on a flatbed trailer yesterday, hauled mini loads, but one load, 30, 40 miles down the road, and I was driving with my wife and my girls, and I was like, it would take me 2 years.
Yeah.
to take this load 30 miles down the road to my brother's place without oil and gas. So when you think about it in energy equivalence,
yes,
in that context, how do you think they built the infrastructure in the ancient world? Slavery, human servitude, and a whole bunch of horses, mules, and whatever else you could get for raw labor to build those types of infrastructure. And so that's a problem, is we don't want to revert back, especially with the increased population in the world we have compared to the ancient world. I mean, we're at billions of people.
Right.
And that's what some of the scientists are making the point of pushing away from nitrogen fertilizer as well. Is you do away with nitrogen fertilizer tomorrow, within a short time frame, a couple years, half the world population no longer exists, because right. half of the world, for their basic substance of food, depends on nitrogen fertilizer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Oops.
Where's the cost-benefit analysis there?
Apparently we haven't taken that into consideration. Well, that's the thing. You look at all these little microcosms. I always go back. I'll find it and find the date. But when we interviewed Dr. Patrick Moore from Greenpeace, he was telling us that he got out of Greenpeace when they wanted to ban chlorine. You know, they just came up with some crazy idea. Let's ban chlorine. He's like, you can't ban chlorine. It's an element on the periodic table. So sometimes the people that are coming up with these ideas aren't necessarily the, okay, they're just not the sharpest tools in the shed. Let's just throw it down. it won't be the last mean thing I say. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with our guest, Nathan Dashmaker.
I can't do everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing it.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. In a recent court case, Freed v. Garland, it was determined both medical and recreational marijuana users have no right to firearms because marijuana use was associated with elevated risky decision-making. It is beyond dispute that marijuana users experience altered mental states that affect their judgment, creating irrational and unpredictable behavior. There is a clear relationship between the bevy of recent active shooters and marijuana use. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Playing in the places where they're coming up with the policy.
I got news for you.
Music.
We're a long way from Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
What?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, stop it, Bill. Just, you hater.
I know it. We're not there yet.
So I did find the quote from Peter Huntsman. So he says, "Think about the year 1970. That's the year we hit $1 trillion GDP, and the year Jimmy Page and Robert Plant wrote the great song Stairway to Heaven. A great year, right? Well, today we're emitting roughly 6,500 metric." Tons of CO2. The same thing we were emitting in 1970. And look at how much more electricity we're using. And look at how many more transportation and miles we're driving. We've expanded the economy 30 times over, nearly, and the core CO2 has stayed flat. We should be celebrating that achievement.
Yeah, we don't want to mention that.
Huh. I guess I haven't heard that anywhere. Apparently that's not being widely publicized. But it kind of goes to your point, Nathan.
Yeah, that's a good quote, and very, very true. Because we are very. Meanwhile, we're shipping our coal over to China and Japan to burn, which Japan's pretty efficient. China probably not so much so in their coal burning facilities, which they're building a lot of them. Well, they're not going net zero.
No time soon.
By 2050. So yeah, that's a good quote in that context of not only why is that not, so we haven't increased emissions and we've had significant increase of economic output, but another thing to take into consideration there is the U.S., even with the gigatons of electricity, or not electricity, CO2 emissions that are emitted, is still a really small percentage of the global scene in certain contexts. And also the human contribution of CO2 into the atmosphere in comparison. One of the things I ask people when this discussion starts with CO2 and emissions and carbon and blah, 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 is how much of the greenhouse effect is CO2, and how much of that is from natural processes, and what are the natural contributors without leaving humans out? Most people can't answer that. But the answer is oceans, all plant vegetation in the fall that dies and decays emits gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere. There's charts out there that you can look at that have been put together that show the comparison. First of all, the greenhouse effect only makes up, like, I don't know, 2% of the atmosphere to begin with. 95% of that is water vapor. Then there's some other gases, and then like 3% or something of that 5% is CO2. And a huge percentage of that CO2 is
of the atmosphere, for heaven's sakes, or lower.
Exactly.
And then you look at...
super minuscule.
It's super small, and you look at, besides that, and I really wonder if Leighton Stewart's still around. Is he still around? Do you know him at all? He's a super nice guy.
I don't.
He came on years ago, and he kept talking about how CO2 makes plants grow. You know, I mean, that was his bottom line. It's like, well, no kidding. We all learned that in sixth grade. So... CO2 is actually not a bad thing, not a pollutant, and here we are destroying the developed world to guard against something that isn't harming us when we have a volcano that happens under the ocean.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to mention that.
Yeah, you got the volcano under the ocean that everybody kind of forgot. Well, actually, they didn't forget. They weren't told about it. And that put out more than, I don't know, civilization for a bazillion years or something.
Yeah, the water vapor that went into the atmosphere on that volcano, they said, will affect our weather for probably the next 5 to 10 years.
So not a bazillion? I was wrong.
Probably not a bazillion, but it was it was a lot of water vapor, and it was seen from space, the amount of water that went up into the atmosphere. But they didn't, the media didn't mention that, because that's kind of contrary to what they want everybody to believe, and it's not going to really add to their debate of global warming and what's causing it, because what you just said, I mean, there's a lot of natural things out there that are contributing, and that volcano alone was huge, and nobody mentions it. Nobody says anything about it.
Exactly. Well, there's a lot of that going on. The problem with central planning is most of them are not willing to admit to their mistakes, and that's true in the sciences as well. So
I'm shocked.
Yeah. So volcanoes, yeah, is a big one. Like I said, the water vapor. And don't say that too loud. They'll start coming after water vapor too. Well, now it's water vapor.
Taxes on our water vapor.
So I've actually submitted. I'm of the persuasion that the reason carbon is the target is because our economy is a carbon-based economy. It's actually the hub from which all economic transactions come in and out of, because carbon is virtually everything materially we deal with, and the base load of energy that gives us the capacity to transport and get those products out into the market. So this is about economics. And I think we need a renaissance in the policy arena and administrative process back to fundamental economic principles, because we have Keynesian economics and way out there economists And now we have even this modern monetary theory, which is just print and spend, and there is no consequence because we can just keep printing.
Right. That's working out well.
Those are huge, huge systemic issues with that economic process. And I mentioned this kind of a little bit earlier, but that's one thing that pre-existed the constitutions of Western civilization is the market. We didn't create the market with the Constitution. We created the Constitution to safeguard the market. The freedom of the individual and private property and the market mechanisms of contracting.
Well, they were able to grow out of
mutually in society.
That. Yeah, we were able to develop those things because we prioritized innovation and the product of individual labor. You know, I mean, you look at societies that operate on a collective system, and China is a great example. So on a collective system, you're not allowed to innovate because you're not supposed to be thinking for yourself. You're supposed to be doing what you're told. So when you tell all your people to do what they're told, and they actually, you know, over centuries are trained to do that, they don't innovate. They copy well, but they don't innovate. And that's part of their problem. That's why they steal all our stuff, because they don't have innovators. But in a free society, you have lots of innovation. And it's interesting because Huntsman brings that up too. He said, you know, why are we not letting the market run? Because we will, our congressman here talks about that too, that if we let the market work, the innovation that people would come up with, which got us to this point, will also solve the problems in the future.
And that can't be planned.
Right.
That's the thing about...
You will innovate. Do it.
The free market is... There's so many independent levels of action of individual people functioning unilaterally from one another. There's a complexity to it, but in a free market context, you can't plan it. And as economists have made the point also, you also can't, once the free market spontaneous mechanisms are established and the order is there, you can't perpetuate it with planning either. And that's what they're trying to do now is use the market frameworks. They're borrowing from the free market context to try to put, because otherwise they're just reaching in the dark or placing value on something. Because
right.
Value is also something that's determined through those mutual contracts and relationships and the willing to buy, to purchase, and to sell. That's agreed upon on mutual contractual terms between individuals functioning on the market. Government can't even function without that framework to have a framework of understanding value and economic value to certain products and certain services. And so the market is absolutely essential, and that leads me to a point that Nicolay, I may be saying his name wrong, Tangen, who is the chief executive of the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, he predicted that the Biden administration's obsession with greening the economy will mean that high inflation is a permanent fixture for the foreseeable future. He said, quote, companies benefiting from economically ineffective and inefficient projects through applying for green subsidies has fundamentally flipped free market principles on their head, an arrangement that is sure to invite economic chaos.
Wow, end I quote. Love him. He's my new hero. After you.
Well, he makes a very good economic point there.
Yes.
That... And so back to this solar, what we were discussing earlier with solar and wind and picking winners and losers and driving generation shifts on our grid towards these ineffective and inefficient projects and driving dollars that way. So another work I've been reading that corresponds with this is Murray Rothbard's book, on the power in the market, man, economy, and state. And in there he says, transfer spending or subsidies distort the market by coercively penalizing the efficient for the benefit of the inefficient. Subsidies prolong the life of inefficient firms and prevent the flexibility of the market from fully satisfying consumer wants. The greater the extent of government subsidy, the more the market is prevented from working, the more resources are frozen in inefficient ways, and the lower will be the standard of living of everyone. Furthermore, the more government intervenes and subsidizes, the more caste conflict will be created in society for individuals and groups who will benefit only at one another's expense. End quote.
Gosh, I think...
So there's another good one.
I think somebody wrote a book about that. I think her name was Ayn Rand, and I believe it was called Atlas Shrugged. that's like if you're going to put a synopsis of Atlas... If you want to see how it turns out, just read Atlas Shrugged. Because that is exactly what happens in her story that she wrote back in the 1950s, obviously, by channeling the future somehow, and looking at, hey, what happens if we let bureaucracy run the world, we stopped using common sense, and we crushed all the producers? You know, what does that mean for regular people? And what that means is the end of freedom and innovation and happiness as we know it, truly. Bad news.
And that's always been the battle.
That is always the battle. It never, and it's never going to stop. We will always have to push back on that as citizens in a free market. We will always have to defend it. Nathan is our guest next hour. We have him as a hostage for another hour. And you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, how much fun is that? Here's a little song about compliance, just in case you were into it. You might not be into it.
We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance.